Good evening. The first thing I'd like to do this evening, for those of you who saw the PBS documentary last night, since it ran so close to time for Vespers, is to ask if there are any questions or comments concerning the documentary that anybody would like to ask or bring up. Yes?
What would be your most critical thought about that video? Did it portray him as you would have portrayed him, or did it portray him as the media would have portrayed him?
Well, let me begin by saying that I sat on the advisory board representing the Merton Legacy Trust. I would say, with one exception, it portrayed Thomas Merton as well, I think, as he could be portrayed in an hour. The one exception to that, I might as well share with you, is that the advisory board unanimously felt that there was no good reason to mention the fact that Thomas Merton may have had an illegitimate son, since the facts on that whole incident are somewhat blurred, and since in the final print of the documentary they did nothing to tie it up. It was just sort of mentioned and then dropped. So far as I know, that's the only place that the producers actually ignored what the advisory board had to say. Any other questions or comments? Yes?
Was there ever any question that his accident was not an accident?
Yes, that has been suggested. There are basically four theories about his death. The first theory, the one which came through in the documentary, was that he had showered and was still wet, came out, and you saw the standing fan. The fan was actually plugged in the room next door with a closed door, and apparently the wire was frayed where the door had rubbed against it. That theory is that he reached down to adjust the fan, whatever, and it shocked him, electrocuted him, and he pulled the fan over on himself. The other theory, the one that I particularly happen to like the most, is that he had a heart attack, reached for the fan to support himself, and as he pulled the fan over on him, it shorted out. It was, as they said, laying across his stomach, and his abdomen was very badly burned. The reason I happen to subscribe to that one is that participants in the Bangkok conference said that he did not look well at all that morning, that his face was very flushed, and that before he gave his talk, he appeared to be extremely nervous, which was not ordinary for Thomas Merton. He was usually a pretty cool and collected individual. The other two theories. The one is that the CIA had him killed. I don't happen to put much credence in that. I think there were a lot of variables in the way he died, and that it's a little too James Bondian even for the CIA. The reason some people have liked that theory, those of you who were alive in 1968 will remember that it was a very tense year. We had gone through two major assassinations. A president had abdicated. There was turmoil and unrest on our campuses. It was a time of crisis. I have no problem with the fact that Thomas Merton, who had become the guru, particularly of the Catholic peace movement, advisor to the Berrigans, to Jim Forrest, to the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and so forth, was undoubtedly under surveillance. I'm convinced that that is true. But I still don't think that the CIA at that point would have had any reason to do Merton in. The fourth and last theory, and the one that holds the least water as far as I'm concerned, is that he committed suicide. But I think Thomas Merton was still too much tied into his own Roman Catholic tradition, which considers suicide a sin, to have committed suicide. Okay, any other questions or comments? Yes.
How is Merton regarded by the Catholic Church?
at this point in time.
Yes, especially officially.
Well, there has been no official statement or anything that could even be construed as an official statement. I'm sure, as you probably know, that the Vatican moves slowly when it moves at all. I would say that the very fact that many of the things Thomas Merton wrote about, many of the ideas he had, have been accepted by us generally as a society, means that most Roman Catholics today now look at Thomas Merton as something of a prophet for our times. There are still some who don't like him. A great many of the priests in the Louisville Archdiocese who knew him personally don't like him. Our executive vice president at Bellarmine College never cared for Merton much at all and would tell people, I knew him, he was no great shakes. I remember one time a young woman said, what would you suggest, Father Treese, that I read of Thomas Merton's? And he said, read anything you want to. I don't read that stuff myself. So there are those who still feel that he was out of step with the Roman Catholic ministry. Okay, anything else? Yeah.
Will the paper be shown again this week?
We've had a request already, and yes, I think we will try to arrange a time. So we'll try to announce that when we do. Yes?
Could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do? I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to get to that in a moment.
I missed out on that part.
Okay. No, I had not said anything about that before. I am Robert Daggy. I'm director of the Thomas Merton Study Center, which is at Bellarmine College in Louisville, Kentucky. We hold the bulk of Thomas Merton's literary estate. Under canon law, even with a vow of poverty, a monk or a nun retains control of a literary estate and can dispose of it as they wish. In the mid-60s, when interest in Merton was widening, it was actually a mutual decision between him and his abbot that they did not want the Abbey of Gethsemane to become a center for scholarship. They felt that compromised their vocation to silence and solitude, and they didn't want to become a mecca for scholars in any way. Bellarmine College happens to be the archdiocesan college in the same archdiocese as the Abbey. Also, by his depositing materials there at that time, it gave Merton an additional excuse to come into Louisville if he wanted to. And so in 1963, the first gift of materials came to Bellarmine College. It is an enormous collection. That's one of the things I did want to say. He was a very prolific writer, wrote probably somewhere close to 90 books, depending on how one counts them. Some of his books were limited editions of things that appeared in other books, but there have been about 90 individual titles that he wrote. We currently have on file over 1,200 essays and articles which he wrote. We have correspondence after he was given carte blanche to deal with his own correspondence. By 1959, his abbot, Dom James Fox, just despaired of trying to read all the incoming mail and outgoing mail. So he just gave Merton carte blanche. Merton was still convinced that the abbot was reading a lot of his mail, so he advised some of his correspondents, if they didn't want the abbot to read it, to put conscience material on the envelope. And then, of course, the abbot was not supposed to read it. We have correspondence files with almost 2,000 individuals, and some of the files have well over 100 letters in them. We have 632 talks on tape. As you saw in the documentary, he was, for 10 years, the chief educational officer at the Abbey, and these tapes are primarily of his lectures and conferences to novices. He thought he was something of an artist. We have about 5,000 of his drawings and calligraphies. He also took photographs. We have over 3,000 of those. And as far as materials about Merton, I can't even begin to estimate how many articles, essays, and reviews at this point in time have been written about Merton. But it runs, I'd say, close to probably 3,000. And almost 50 books dealing just with Thomas Merton. In the last year, there have been 5 major biographical treatments of Merton. The documentary that we saw last night was one of these. After the documentary was aired, the producers edited the interviews, and a book with the title Merton by Those Who Knew Him Best was published by Harper and Row, which contains these interviews. The title has been called something of a misnomer, and it is, because many of those people, even whom you saw last night, did not really know Merton best. The Dalai Lama, for instance, only encountered him briefly on 2 days. Joan Baez was only at the Abbey once. So that these people were probably not, some of them, those who knew him best. There has been a play written on Merton, a one-man show, which I will be showing the videotape on Saturday, called Winter Rain, 6 images of Thomas Merton, with Thomas Merton portrayed by Michael Moriarty. This has always been a somewhat touchy area in Merton's studies, since Merton himself left a clause that none of his writings were to be used or dramatized on radio, television, or in film. So that the Merton Legacy Trust has always been bound not to allow any of these materials to be used for dramatizations. The reason for this is his autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, was a smash bestseller in the late 1940s. And as with smash bestsellers, that always sort of piques the interest of Hollywood, and indeed it did at that time. And a proposal came through to film The Seven Story Mountain starring Don Ameche as Thomas Merton. The counter proposal, in case Don Ameche didn't meet with approval, was Errol Flynn. And naturally in the 1940s, if you wanted to look for a rake who had been converted, who better than Errol Flynn, even though he never got converted. Well, needless to say, neither Merton nor his abbot were very happy with these proposals. And from then on, Merton, during his lifetime, strenuously resisted any dramatic portrayal of himself. He never saw this one, but so we don't know. The 4th major autobiographical treatment in the last year has been the entry in the Twain American Authors series, written by Professor Victor Kramer, and titled simply Thomas Merton. But probably the most significant, after 16 years, the authorized biography for which Merton had left provision in his trust agreement was finally published, The Seven Mountains of Thomas Merton by Michael Mott. There is a copy on reserve in the library. Michael Mott had access to materials that have been closed to all other scholars. Pending the publication of the authorized biography and 25 years after Merton's death. So these materials will finally open for the use of scholars in 1993. Now, I was asked last week to give a suggested reading list for people who might know little or nothing about Thomas Merton. So let me run through this rather quickly. These are not necessarily what I think are the best, but what I think would make a good core reading list. I think if one is dealing with Merton, one always has to start with The Seven Story Mountain. It is the biggie. It's the book that put Merton on the map. It has been the most consistently reprinted of his writings. It has been translated into some 16 languages throughout the world. Though Merton himself later disavowed The Seven Story Mountain and said that he would write it much differently if he were to write it in the 1960s, he commented at one point that it had been written by a narrow and rather callous and callow young man. because at that point in time, Merton was still very much into a Roman Catholic mindset, which did not have much tolerance for other religious traditions. But I still think it is the most important work, his classic work, and the one that will live. I happen to like, personally, Thomas Merton's journal writings the best, because I think he was at his best as a writer, and others agree with me, in the sort of short, episodic, epigrammatic, literary form that we see in diaries. Now, the first of his diaries that was published was in 1953, called The Sign of Jonas. And this happens to be my particular favorite Merton book. But I also think it belongs on any basic reading list. Probably his most significant book of meditations was Seeds of Contemplation, originally published in 1949. It was the only book that Merton revised during his lifetime, and it was reissued in 1962 by New Directions. That's what ND means here. I should say here. These are available now in Harcourt Brace Harvest paperbacks, and this is available in a New Directions paperback. It was retitled New Seeds of Contemplation, and if one is looking for a book of Thomas Merton's meditations about the contemplative life, this is the one I would advise be picked up. His journal from the mid-50s into the 60s that was mentioned in the documentary last night, Conjectures of the Guilty Bystander, available now in an image paperback. And finally, what some consider his best work, I don't happen to, I prefer The Sign of Jonas, Zen and the Birds of Appetite, a collection of his essays on Zen Buddhism, published the year he died by New Directions. And I have added, simply because I think Merton's letters show him in a different light. He's more casual, more candid, more open, and more honest in his letters. And the first huge volume of his selected letters was published in May, called The Hidden Ground of Love, The Letters of Thomas Merton on Religious Experience and Social Concerns, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is not the kind of book that one should read, by the way, from beginning to end. It's the kind of book you pick up and browse through. If you try to read it through from beginning to end, I don't think it works too well. For those who might be interested in his poetry, in 1961, and still available from New Directions in paperback, was a volume of selected poems. And in 1977, another monumental volume, the collected poems, now available in a paperback about that thick. Of works about Merton, I would say that most of the works about Merton now are probably out of print, and many of those, mercifully, shall I say, out of print. The early things published about Merton tended to be doctoral dissertations. And those of you who have read doctoral dissertations know that no matter what you do to them, they still read like doctoral dissertations and are pretty tough sledding, like walking through mud. But I would suggest these five books. The one I've already mentioned, Michael Mott's Authorized Biography. And again, like the letters, this may not be the kind of thing one wants to read through from beginning to end, but to pick up and browse through. To my mind, the best shorter biographical treatment of Merton to date was written by an English woman named Monica Furlong. Some of you may know her, one of her books of meditations was called Traveling In. She's very well known in England. Called Merton, a Biography, published by Harper and Row in 1980. Another very good one, I think, because it attempts to put Merton into the context of the 20th century. Many of the early things really just repeated what Merton had said himself and didn't give one much perspective or try to put him in the context of his time. Anthony Padovano's book, The Human Journey, Thomas Merton, Symbol of a Century, published by Doubleday in 1982, does attempt to do that. I don't agree with everything Tony has to say, but he has his own axe to grind, and that's fine. I probably have mine to grind, too. Patrick Hart, who is a Cistercian monk and was Thomas Merton's secretary, in 1974 put together a collection of essays called Thomas Merton Monk, A Monastic Tribute. This was revised in 1983 and is available from Cistercian publications. And anyone who's interested in what Thomas Merton's fellow monks, including his abbot Dom James Fox, thought of him, can pick this book up. One doesn't find out too much about what Abbot Fox actually thought, because he just says, oh, what a wonderful, obedient son he was. And finally, probably the best work on Merton as a literary figure was written by a Canadian whom some of you may know, George Woodcock, Thomas Merton, Monk and Poet, A Critical Study, published in Canada by Douglas and McIntyre and by Farrar, Straus and Giroux simultaneously in 1978. So I think that would make a rather good basic reading list. Now we'll try to get to our topic for tonight in keeping with this day of remembrance and hope, and Thomas Merton's concern for peace. When Thomas Merton entered the Abbey in 1941, he was totally convinced that he was leaving the world behind him. And in fact, that's what he wanted to do. For the first few years of his monastic existence, he tried to practice what the rule of Saint Benedict calls contemptus mundi, contempt for the world. A feeling that the world had nothing to offer, that the monk, if he was going to be a proper monk, turns his back totally on that world, on any of the comforts of that world, on any of the enjoyments of that world. As you saw in the documentary, Cistercian life at the time when Merton entered the abbey was very austere, very strict. They did sleep in a common dormitory without heat in winter or air conditioning in summer, on straw pallets. They got up in the middle of the night at 3 in the winter, at 3 in the summer, 4 in the winter, and went immediately to prayers. Their diet was very meager. In fact, fasting was encouraged. They took 5 vows: poverty, celibacy, obedience, stability, and conversion of manners, as it was called, the process by which a person becomes a monk. They did observe silence, which was not a vow. It was a rule of silence, but that fell under the vow of obedience since it was a rule. And when Merton entered the abbey, they spoke not at all, even during work. Over the centuries, the Cistercians had developed a sign language. And if it was absolutely necessary to communicate with another monk during work, or to communicate that the abbot wanted to see him, or a message of crucial importance, then they used sign language. The monk spoke to anyone, if they spoke at all, only to the abbot. And usually that was in a yearly review or something of that sort. In Merton's early days at the abbey, what I consider certainly one of the hardest things they had to do, they wore their wool habits all year round. And believe me, any of you who may have been in Kentucky in the summer will know what a hardship that was when our temperatures soar into the 90s and we have humidity of 98 and 99%. One does not want to be out in a hayfield in a wool habit, believe me. Not until 1953 did Rome give dispensation only for Cistercians in Kentucky to dispense with their wool habits in the summer. So it was a hard life. And Merton seemed to thrive on this life. But during the early portion of his life, which I will go into more tomorrow, he was convinced that he had no part in the world and that the world had nothing to do with him. He was convinced at this period of his life that a person could withdraw from the world and its concerns. And this continued into the 50s when he began to have a series of crises about this. Because before he had entered the Abbey, Merton had been extremely concerned about various problems, about the coming war in Europe, about black Americans. He had worked for a time at Catherine Duhek Doherty's settlement house in Harlem. He had been very socially concerned and then had attempted to turn his back on these concerns. As you saw in the documentary last night, eventually these feelings reached a head when he was standing at a street corner in Louisville at 4th and Walnut. He experienced a cathartic experience in which all of a sudden, in a rather mystical flash, he saw his oneness with the rest of humanity, saw that he could not separate himself from his fellow humans and their concerns. And from that point on, he began to write, and he wrote extensively on various social problems. I should say, if you go to Louisville, at this point in time, don't look for 4th and Walnut. Some people have. It's now 4th and Muhammad Ali. So if you want to actually stand on the corner where Merton stood, go to 4th and Muhammad Ali. He was a thorn for a time in the side of the Roman Catholic hierarchy. He had already begun in the late 50s to publish some articles on peace and war. And this made his superiors very nervous, because ordinary religious at this point in time in the Roman Catholic Church were not supposed to be writing on subjects which might have political overtones. In 1961, the order came through from the Abbot General of the Cistercian Order that he was to write no further essays on the question of peace, that peace was a matter reserved for bishops. This did not, however, stop Thomas Merton. The book that he had in the works at that time, Peace in the Post-Christian Era, was temporarily shelved. But Merton was not a man who did not get mileage out of what he had written. And eventually everything in Peace in the Post-Christian Era was published somewhere else. He did for a time publish in private form, in mimeograph, through his friends, and sending these mimeographs to other religious houses. But eventually this ban was lifted. He also published for a time his articles on peace under pseudonyms. He used a not very clever one in the Catholic Worker, Benedict Monk. And another one that he particularly liked was Marcus J. Frisbee. But he did manage to get these things into print. Thomas Merton's concern for peace had been with him since before he entered the Abbey. He was in Europe when the Nazis took power. He had traveled through Germany in that period in the mid-30s, able to see, like other outside observers, that what was going on in Germany did not seem to be what a Christian might want a government to be. In fact, his early novels that he wrote before he entered the Abbey, only one of which has survived and was published, as my argument with the Gestapo, really is a pacifist novel, pleading for some way to stop and halt the Second World War. Thomas Merton, for a time, as most Catholics did, toyed with the idea of the just war theory, which Catholics and the rest of us have inherited from St. Augustine and through, in later centuries, through St. Thomas Aquinas. Merton, however, became convinced finally that there was no such thing as a just war in our time, particularly with nuclear weapons. The old just war theory had always held that if you are attacked and there is no other way to protect your family and yourself, you are justified in going to war. But Merton couldn't see how even when attacked in our time, retaliation, which would destroy millions of lives and possibly the entire world in the end, could in any way be justified. Let me share with you just a few quick quotes from some of his writings. The Christian struggle for peace depends first of all upon a free response of humans to God's call to the service of his merciful designs. The lack of humankind's response to this call is the most terrible problem of human history. Christ our Lord did not come to bring peace to the world as a kind of spiritual tranquilizer. He brought to his disciples a vocation and a task: to struggle in the world of violence to establish his peace, not only in their hearts, but in society itself. The Christian is and must be, by his very adoption as a child of God in Christ, a peacemaker. There is one winner, only one winner in war. It is war itself. Not truth, not justice, not liberty, not morality. These are the vanquished. War wins, reducing them to total submission. He makes truth serve violence and falsehood. He causes justice to declare not what is just, but what is expedient as well as cruel. War has power to transmute evil into good and good into evil. Do not fear that he will not exercise this power. Now more than ever, he is omnipotent. He is the great force, the evil mystery, the demonic mover of our century, with his globe of sunfire and his pillar of cloud. There is only one winner in war. That winner is not justice, not liberty, not Christian truth. The winner is war itself. As Christians, first of all, in a crisis where the very existence of humankind and the continuation of life itself are at stake, our duty to God the Creator becomes a duty to strive in every way to preserve and protect his creation. Our duty is to help save humanity for which Christ died. I'd like to share with you now, in keeping with this day, Thomas Merton's prose poem concerning the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. This is titled Original Child Bomb, Points for Meditation to be Scratched on the Walls of a Cave. The title is taken from the Japanese. The Japanese characters for the atomic bomb mean, if literally translated, original child. And that is why Merton chose this title, Original Child Bomb. One, in the year 1945, an original child was born. The name Original Child was given to it by the Japanese people, who recognized that it was the first of its kind. Two, on April 12, 1945, Mr. Harry Truman became the President of the United States, which was then fighting the Second World War. Mr. Truman was a vice president who became president by accident when his predecessor died of a cerebral hemorrhage. He did not know as much about the war as the president before him did. He knew a lot less about the war than many people did. About 1 hour after Mr. Truman became president, his aides told him about a new bomb which was being developed by atomic scientists. They called it the atomic bomb. They said scientists had been working on it for 6 years and that it had so far cost $2 billion. They added that its power was equal to that of 20,000 tons of TNT. A single bomb could destroy a city. One of those present added, in a reverent tone, that the new explosive might eventually destroy the whole world. But Admiral Leahy told the president the bomb would never work. 3. President Truman formed a committee of men to tell him if this bomb would work, and if so, what he should do with it. Some members of this committee felt that the bomb would jeopardize the future of civilization. They were against its use. Others wanted it to be used in demonstration on a forest of cryptomeria trees, but not against a civil or military target. Many atomic scientists warned that the use of atomic power in war would be difficult and even impossible to control. The danger would be very great. Finally, there were others who believed that if the bomb were used just once or twice on one or two Japanese cities, there would be no more war. They believed the new bomb would produce eternal peace. 4. In June 1945, the Japanese government was taking steps to negotiate for peace. On one hand, the Japanese ambassador tried to interest the Russian government in acting as a go-between with the United States. On the other hand, an unofficial approach was made secretly through Mr. Alan Dulles in Switzerland. The Russians said they were not interested and that they would not negotiate. Nothing was done about the other proposal, which was, after all, not official. The Japanese high command was not in favor of asking for peace, but wanted to continue the war, even if the Japanese mainland were invaded. The generals believed that the war should continue until everybody was dead. The Japanese generals were professional soldiers. 5. In the same month of June, the president's committee decided that the new bomb should be dropped on a Japanese city. This would be a demonstration of the bomb on a civil and military target. As demonstration, it would be a kind of show. Civilians all over the world love a good show. The destructive aspect of the bomb would be its military one. 6. The same committee also asked if America's friendly ally, the Soviet Union, should be informed of the atomic bomb. Someone suggested that this information would make the Soviet Union even more friendly than it was already. But all finally agreed that the Soviet Union was now friendly enough. 7. There was discussion about which city should be selected as the first target. Some wanted it to be Kyoto, an ancient capital of Japan and a center of the Buddhist religion. Others said no, this would cause bitterness. As a result of a chance conversation, Mr. Stimson, the Secretary of War, had recently read up on the history and beauties of Kyoto. He insisted that this city should be left untouched. Some wanted Tokyo to be the first target, but others argued that Tokyo had already been practically destroyed by fire raids and could no longer be considered a target. So it was decided Hiroshima was the most opportune target, as it had not yet been bombed at all. Lucky Hiroshima. What others had experienced over a period of 4 years would happen to Hiroshima in a single day. Much time would be saved, and time is money. 8. When they bombed Hiroshima, They would put the following out of business: the Ubet Nitrogen Fertilizer Company, the Ubet Soda Company, the Nippon Motor Oil Company, the Sumitomo Chemical Company, the Sumitomo Aluminum Company, and of course, most of the inhabitants. 9. At this time, some atomic scientists protested again, warning that the use of the bomb in war would tend to make the United States unpopular. But the President's Committee was by now fully convinced that the bomb had to be used. Its use would arouse the attention of the Japanese military class and give them food for thought. 10. Admiral Leahy renewed his declaration that the bomb would not explode. 11. On the 4th of July, when the United States, in displays of fireworks, celebrates its independence from British rule, the British and Americans agreed together that the bomb ought to be used against Japan. 12. On July 7th, the Emperor of Japan pleaded with the Soviet government to act as mediator for peace between Japan and the Allies. Molotov said the question would be studied. In order to facilitate this study, Soviet troops in Siberia prepared to attack the Japanese. The Allies had, in any case, been urging Russia to join the war against Japan. However, now that the atomic bomb was nearly ready, some thought it would be better if the Russians took a rest. 13. The time was coming for the new bomb to be tested in the New Mexico desert. A name was chosen to designate this secret operation. It was called Trinity. 14. At 5:30 a.m. on July 16, 1945, a plutonium bomb was successfully exploded in the desert at Alamogordo, New Mexico. It was suspended from a 100-foot steel tower, which evaporated. There was a fireball a mile wide. A great flash could be seen for a radius of 250 miles. A blind woman miles away said she perceived light. There was a cloud of smoke 40,000 feet high. It was shaped like a toadstool. 15. Many who saw the experiment expressed their satisfaction in religious terms. A semi-official report even quoted a religious book, the New Testament. Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. There was an atmosphere of devotion. It was a great act of faith. They believed the explosion was exceptionally powerful. 16. Admiral Leahy, still a doubting Thomas, said that the bomb would not explode when dropped from a plane over a city. Others may have had faith, but he had his own variety of hope. 17. On July 21st, a full written report of the explosion reached President Truman at Potsdam. The report was documented by pictures. President Truman read the report and looked at the pictures before starting out for the conference. When he left, his mood was jaunty and his step was light. 18. That afternoon, Mr. Stimson called on Mr. Churchill and laid before him a sheet of paper bearing a code message about the successful test. The message read, "Babies satisfactorily born." Mr. Churchill was quick to realize that there was more in this than met the eye. Mr. Stimson satisfied his legitimate curiosity. 19. On this same day, 60 atomic scientists who knew of the test signed a petition that the bomb should not be used against Japan without a convincing warning and an opportunity to surrender. At this time, the USS Indianapolis, which had left San Francisco on the 18th, was sailing toward the island of Tinian with some U-235 in a lead bucket. The fissionable material was about the size of a softball, but there was enough for one atomic bomb. Instructions were that if the ship sank, the uranium was to be saved first, before any life. The mechanism of the bomb was on board the USS Indianapolis, but it was not yet assembled. 20. On July 26th, the Potsdam Declaration was issued. An ultimatum was given to Japan. Surrender unconditionally or be destroyed. Nothing was said about the new bomb. The pamphlets dropped all over Japan threatened an enormous air bombardment if the army would not surrender. On July 26th, the USS Indianapolis arrived at Tinian and the bomb was delivered. 21. On July 28th, since the Japanese High Command wished to continue the war, the ultimatum was rejected. A censored version of the ultimatum appeared in the Japanese press with the comment that it was an attempt to drive a wedge between the military and the Japanese people. But the emperor continued to hope that the Russians, after studying his proposal, would help to negotiate a peace. On July 30th, Mr. Stimson revised a draft of the announcement that was to be made after the bomb was dropped on the Japanese target. The statement was much better than the original draft. 22. On August 1st, the bomb was assembled in an air-conditioned hut on Tinian. Those who handled the bomb referred to it as Little Boy. Their care for the original child was devoted and tender. 23. On August 2nd, President Truman was the guest of His Majesty King George VI on board the HMS Renown in Plymouth Harbor. The atomic bomb was praised. Admiral Leahy, who was present, declared that the bomb would not work. His Majesty, George VI, offered a small wager to the contrary. 24. On August 2nd, a special message from the Japanese Foreign Minister was sent to the Japanese ambassador in Moscow. It is requested that further efforts be exerted, since the loss of one day may result in 1,000 years of regret. It is requested that you immediately have a talk with Molotov. But Molotov did not return from Potsdam until the day the bomb fell. 25. On August 4th, the bombing crew on Tinian watched a movie of Trinity, the Alamogordo test. August 5th was a Sunday, but there was little time for formal worship. They said a quick prayer that the war might end very soon. On that day, Colonel Tibbetts, who was in command of the B-29 that was to drop the bomb, felt that his bomber ought to have a name. He baptized it Enola Gay, after his mother in Iowa. Colonel Tibbetts was a well-balanced man and not sentimental. He did not have a nervous breakdown after the bombing, like some of the other members of the crew. 26. On Sunday afternoon, Little Boy was brought out in procession and devoutly tucked away in the womb of Enola Gay. That evening, few were able to sleep. They were as excited as little boys on Christmas Eve. 27. At 1:37 a.m. August 6th, the Weather Scout plane took off. It was named the Straight Flush in reference to the mechanical action of a water closet. There was a picture of one on the plane to make this obvious and evident. 28, at the last minute before taking off, Colonel Tibbetts changed the secret radio call sign from visitor to dimples. The bombing mission would be a kind of flying smile. 29, at 2:45 a.m., Enola Gay got off the ground with difficulty. Over Iwo Jima, she met her escort, two more B-29s, one of which was called the Great Artiste. Together they proceeded to Japan. 30. At 6:40 they climbed to 31,000 feet, the bombing altitude. The sky was clear. It was a perfect morning. 31. At 3:09 they reached Hiroshima and started the bomb run. The city was full of sun. The flyers could see the green grass in the gardens. No fighters rose up to meet them. There was no flak. No one in the city bothered to take cover. 32. The bomb exploded within 100 feet of the aiming point. The fireball was 18,000 feet across. The temperature at the center of the fireball was 100 million degrees. The people who were near the center became nothing. The whole city was blown to bits, and the ruins all caught fire instantly, everywhere, burning briskly. 70,000 people were killed right away or died within a few hours. Those who did not die at once suffered great pain. Few of them were soldiers. 33. The men in the plane perceived that the raid had been successful, but they thought of the people in the city, and they were not perfectly happy. Some felt they had done wrong, but in any case, they had obeyed orders. It was war. 34. Over the radio went the code message that the bomb had been successful. Visible effects greater than Trinity. Proceeding to papacy. Papacy was the code name for Tinian. 35. It took a little while for the rest of Japan to find out what had happened to Hiroshima. Papers were forbidden to publish any news of the new bomb. A four-line item said that Hiroshima had been hit by incendiary bombs and added, "It seems that some damage was caused to the city and its vicinity." 36. Then the military governor of the prefecture of Hiroshima issued a proclamation full of martial spirit. To all the people without hands, without feet, with their faces falling off, with their intestines hanging out, with their whole bodies full of radiation, he declared, "We must not rest a single day in our war effort. We must bear in mind that the annihilation of a stubborn enemy is our road to revenge." He was a professional soldier. 37. On August 8th, Molotov finally summoned the Japanese ambassador. At last, neutral Russia would give an answer to the emperor's inquiry. Molotov said coldly that the Soviet Union was declaring war on Japan. 38. On August 9th, another bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, though Hiroshima was still burning. On August 11th, the emperor overruled his high command and accepted the peace terms dictated at Potsdam. Yet for 3 days, discussion continued until on August 14th, the surrender was made public and final. 39. Even then, the Soviet troops thought they ought to fight in Manchuria just a little longer. They felt that even though they could not, at this time, be of help in Japan, it would be worthwhile if they displayed their goodwill in Manchuria or even in Korea. 40. As to the original child that was now born, President Truman summed up the philosophy of the situation in a few words. "We found the bomb," he said, "and we used it." 41. Since that summer, many other bombs have been found. What is going to happen? At the time of writing, after a season of brisk speculation, men seem to be fatigued by the whole question. It is time for Vespers.